So Thursday evening was the first night of Passover, the Jewish festival commemorating their escape from slavery in Egypt and the beginning of their freedom. I want to take a few minutes this morning looking at the story from a Unitarian Universalist perspective as a myth depicting the transformation of a person or a people from bondage, external political bondage, and internal psychological bondage, but release, that Exodus, the Passover is about the release from bondage and liberation into freedom. So, Exodus first, we have 4 points. First, Exodus as a story. Now, it's impossible to discern historical events, really, about Exodus. I mean, it's pure myth. Because we barely know anything. We have no contemporary evidence outside the Bible of that story. We know a little bit about that time, and plausible reconstructions run the whole gamut. I mean, about the Red Sea and the Sea of Reeds and da da da. Everybody trying to figure out, well, what happened and talk about it. But let's parse through a little bit. The literalist reconstruction of events, and there are a lot of biblical scholars who try to, they think if they can just find, get to the facts, then it'd be clear. So there's a lot of effort to get to the facts, and what we do know is that the Exodus, or the story, happened in the 13th century BCE, or before Common Era. The Pharaoh of the plagues, that's Exodus 15, about the frogs and the locusts and all that, and the firstborn, the last of the plagues, was Ramses II. And we can, that can be determined, not that we know what happened in his court, as the Bible account tells us, but we do know that at the time alleged for this to have taken place, the Pharaoh was Ramses II from 1279 to 1213 B.C. Remember, it goes backwards. Now, the metaphorical reconstruction is much more complicated. It's how I get it. So the literalist interpretation is there are all these plagues, and then in the middle of the night, there's the Passover of God, and the firstborn were spared, and then Pharaoh's freaked, and he says, all right, get out. And Moses grabs everybody. They don't have time for waiting for the bread to rise or anything, and off they go. All right, that, and it happened in Egypt, and they crossed over, and then they wandered around unknown for a long time where they were going, and finally they moved into Canaan, and Joshua fit the battle and all that. But my Old Testament professor, Norman Gottwald, said, no. That's not what happened. Here's what happened. Go to that time, the 13th century B.C., and what you have in modern-day Fertile Crescent, with Palestine, Israel, what you have is the Egyptians were in control. They were an empire, and Egyptian forms and everything existed. And then over the next 200 years, there was the people, the slave, the oppressed people in that part of the world slowly got their act together, established a covenant, became a cohesive people, and they didn't escape Egypt. Egypt left Canaan. Egypt left, and they were here. And they celebrated all these things, but it wasn't a geographic transformation. It was a psychological and cultural transformation. The tyranny described reflects Egypt's political and economic domination of the land of Canaan in the late Bronze Age, what we call the tribal period of Israel. The conquest of Canaan came from within. The following 200 years were a period of growing local autonomy. Some inspired by what Gottwald would call the Yahweh cult, all right? And the Yahweh cult affirmed three things. radical monotheism, the first, depends whether you're Catholic or Protestant, but the first commandment, I am the Lord thy God who has taken thee from thy house of bondage, thou shalt honor me before all others. Now it's worth noting, it doesn't say in lieu of all others. It doesn't say, and despise all of us. Honor me before all of us. Yeah, because I'm the unity of it all. So that's the radical monotheism. Then the value of covenant, being a covenanted people, we commit to each other. You know, the covenant that if we follow these rules, we'll be favored by God, by the universe. And then the third part is utter dependence on one another. And that's the covenant in action, okay? That what the Israelites did that nobody else had done there before, they all had kings. They had a king, and that would they pledge your fealty to the king. But the Israelites said, no, no, the collective spirit of the people is our king. The collective spirit, that's the Yahweh cult. That's the spirit of life and love and in that informs everything. And that's what's God or king for the ancient Israel. So I finally got to David, you know, that collapsed. But for many hundred years, their king was a collective spirit. And now theirs also was an oral culture. And the stories were shared around the campfire and hearth. And they would tell stories about, you know, these cultists would go, oh, yeah, listen what Yahweh did for us. You know, the trumpet blew, and somebody else says, oh, yeah, and we were really hung up, but we were going to drown, and then there was some kind of tie, and we got through the water, and then all these stories collectively over many hundred years become a shared story in this creation myth of Exodus. The song of the sea, that's Exodus 1 through 8, is that really depicts their rushing off through 15, 1 through 8, through the Red Sea. It's one of the oldest passages in the Bible, but it was spoken orally hundreds of years before it was first written down. Okay, so that's the literalist story. Now, there's another way to understand it. Mythic paradigm. It's more than a one-time thing. It doesn't just happen in the, you know, what is that, 3,800 years ago. It's happening all the time, right now. Myth and ritual go together. Exodus, in this, they always go together. The story is the myth. Exodus. The ritual is the Passover. You act it out, and everybody learns it by heart, and you take it into your body. Now, slavery, the movement from slavery to freedom at mythic paradigm, slavery is being stuck in a narrow place, and you cross over into covenantal relationship, and now you're free. You leave your slavery behind when you bind together with like-minded, imaginative people for creative purposes. That, in a nutshell, is how I see Exodus. You leave slavery behind when you bind together with like-minded, imaginative people for creative purposes and sustaining and earth-generative purposes. Now, of course, there's often a long time out in the wilderness before that freedom is realized. And you've got to get your sea legs. So, Exodus as a story, Exodus as a paradigm, a story that's always happening in everyone's life. So, third, modern examples, what I'm talking about. I don't know if anybody saw, what was it, 6 years ago? I think it was 2006, that's 10 years ago, the movie Amazing Grace, about William Wilberforce, who was an English legislator, member of the House of Commons, who was very involved in, back, the key guy to outlaw the slave trade in England. But he kept at it for decades, and it was a cool movie. In the 1780s, so just after the American Revolution, he had this conversion, a personal crossing of the Red Sea, and he became committed to anti-slavery, which he saw as a terrible evil. And he was recruited then, he talked to some people, including William Penn and others, and recruited to the abolitionist cause and tried to help his countrymen get it too. So well, he introduces legislation for 20 years, and he generates and sustains what little funky movement there was. Until, in 1807, March 25th, Act Banning Slavery passed, and it was the first really nail in the coffin of the international slave trade. Now, Wilberforce's health suffered. He was maligned, he became addicted, but he kept at it and eventually led his people out of the wilderness. That is, the English people, out of the wilderness of exploitive, imperialistic racism, and all of us on a path to a much more equitable way of life. Most of us are more familiar with the work of Martin Luther King. Wilberforce was a white guy. Martin King was not. He was a black man, but he was an equally important modern liberator. In 65 through 67, he began to speak of the need for fundamental changes in the political and economic life of our nation. So before that, you know, the hero that's commemorated on Martin Luther King Day is the man who helped in the integration struggle. But after that was accomplished, King started to speak out against the war and against the maldistribution of resources in our economic life. And he began in particular questioning the Vietnamese War and the whole American empire that and the militarism that sustained it. In 67 and 68, he voiced opposition to the war and supporting the redistribution of our resources to correct injustice. In his famous Riverside Church address, he elaborated, from Vietnam to South Africa to Latin America, King said, the United States was on the wrong side of world revolution. He questioned our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America, and asked why the United States was suppressing revolutions of the shirtless and barefoot people in the third world instead of supporting them. In 1968, King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference organized the Poor People's Campaign to address economic injustice issues. Now, Martin King's vision of a renewed America, one, as he put it, that lives up to its creed and maintains its covenant with the poor and the marginalized, well, that vision inspired many of us too. And this is how, in the last years of his life, Martin King grew to understand freedom. He cast the vision, but he never saw it actualized, like Moses. He never made it to the promised land. He was killed. But his vision lives on. As myth, Exodus isn't about culture heroes only. It's about the hero inside everyone, in your own heart, in your own conscience, in your own sometimes very frightened self. Mythic events are paradigmatic events, and that means also that they're paradigmatic internally. That Exodus is about liberating yourself. Myths are always lenses through which we can understand and explain political events and social events, but even more, they're lenses through which we can understand ourselves. Myths describe in poetic emotional language internal events and passages. So by way of example, I'll consider my own life and my own first metaphorical steps out of Egypt. So that was June, I'm thinking of June 1972. I'd gotten out of college. I was off the parental bankroll. That song, you know, by the Beatles, right? But out of college, money spent, see no future, pay no rent. Boy, I was sure there. And so I didn't know what to do, so I went back home to where I grew up in Cleveland. To my childhood home, and there I went, and I was there for 3 days. I have to tell you, I wasn't there 3 hours, and I knew I could not stay. I simply could not do it. And then this A woman I knew from college, Lisa Kay, called me up from Queens, New York, from Jamaica, Queens, Lisa, and which I've heard is the most polyglot zone in the United States, Jamaica. And Lisa was kind of polyglot. She called me up and said, there's a job waiting for you with Central Brooklyn Model Cities, this great society program in Bedford-Stuyvesant, part of Brooklyn, a pretty tough neighbor. But you've got to be here in 3 days, 150 Hinsdale Street, Brooklyn. Now, this was late June of 1972, and probably none of you remember because you're out here in sunny California, but there was a hurricane called Agnes that just dumped tons of water over the Northeast and up the Potomac River and then parked over western Pennsylvania. I had 3 days. I had no money, remember? Out of college, my son. So I got my mother to give me a ride to the corner of Interstate 271 and U.S. Route 422 to hitchhike. Now, Mom never approved of my hitchhike, and my father didn't care too much. But my mother was absolutely, but so it was a struggle for her, too, to drop me off there. And I am not kidding you, it was raining so bad. I had a poncho on, it was just so, my shoes were soaked. I'm standing there, and I start thinking, my stepfather said I could get an interview down at the bank. Maybe I should cut my hair. You know, he really has my best interests at heart. And then something inside me said, no, I cannot go back there. I'm going to get to 150 Hinsdale Street. Until I possibly can't make it, I'm going to be standing here. I stood there about another 60 seconds. I've been there now 25 minutes. I stood there another 60 seconds. The guy in a brand new Audi, a black guy, he pulls up. He says, hey, you going on? I said, oh, I'm so wet. I've been embarrassed. Again. Get in. And he drives me through the Ohio Turnpike. I didn't wait 60 seconds for another ride. 13 rides in a row right to my sister's front door on the Upper East Side. And I got that job. But here's the thing. I got out of Egypt. When that guy dropped me off at the turnpike, I said, I wish I could pay you back. He said, well, you can. Help out the next guy. And I think about that almost every day. It's up to each of us, personally, to cross the Red Sea within if we ever want to get beyond our conventional program. Programming that can turn you into a slave if you're not paying attention to your heart and your true feelings. It looks like we'll drown sometimes, but it always looks that way. Consider William Wilberforce and all that he went through for so many years to be a true liberator of so many of us. And getting through the flood is just the beginning. It's terrifying. But that's the truth about freedom. But here's the thing. Freedom leads to life, vitality, creativity. Freedom also leads to peace because we each have each other, the meaning of covenant. We're not compelled to compete quite the same way, but to embrace and support. And finally, freedom leads to justice. William Wilberforce and Martin Luther King both led their people, all of us, out of bondage by affirming universalism. The abolition and the civil rights movements were moral crusades for freedom and justice. Once we lose that high ground, all we have is a power struggle, which has never been a persuasive means for the weaker to deal with the stronger and entrenched. But with a commitment to life and to one another and to justice, we are free. On our way to freedom, at any rate, arm in arm, struggling through the wilderness with our eyes forever on the prize. This is the meaning of Passover. Blessings. So may it be, and so may it be in all of our hearts.